Weekly weights and weekly weights, and we lift weights and we are mates, and we go on dates because we lift weights and love the weights and love the gym.
Weekly Weights with Alex and Will.
Welcome to Weekly Weights. This is episode 11. I'm Will Berkman. With me, as always, is Alex Hayes. And just a quick shout out again to our friend Lachlan McDonald, who is a lyrical genius, for putting together another awesome theme song for us.
So today we're going to be recording a Q&A, and Will and I have both put up stories on our Instagram asking for questions. So we're going to answer probably all of them today. So first of all, thank you everyone who gave us some questions.
Yeah, we'll name them individually when they come up.
Yeah, so the first one we're going to go with is from Matt Bartholomew, at underscore Matt Bartholomew on Instagram, if you don't know who that is.
Yeah, he needs to pick up a couple of followers.
Yeah, he doesn't really have much of a reach. He asked, what is the value in missing lifts, aka not going 9 out of 9? What do you think, Will?
Okay, I'm not sure that I would ever aim to not go 9 for 9. This is actually something we discussed with Amir on episode 2, but I do think you can sort of turn a negative into a positive. So Wilksy at the coaching course actually advocates for occasionally letting beginners go out for a lift that maybe is just too hard to sort of light a fire in them. I wouldn't do that deliberately. I actually think he's wrong there. But what I do think can happen is if you give somebody a lift that perhaps their training and their prior attempts have indicated are there, and then they make a technical error, and you know, with the maximum weights, it's often technical errors that they have made in training again, they'll miss very narrowly, and then that probably reinforces to the lifter that the things that you've been working on are still works in progress, and it can sort of light the fire in them. But I would never plan to miss, if that makes sense. I would just make your third attempt close enough to limit weights once people are sort of confident competing that if they do miss, there's sort of a lesson in them and they're not disheartened.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think it gives the coach an indication of the sort of weakness that the lifter has in that particular lift.
Yeah, like I can agree.
If they'll fail, they'll usually fail a certain way, and then that will indicate, you know, something to work on in training.
Yeah.
I think another benefit, which is something that you spoke about, was being okay with failure and being able to put the lift aside and move on to the next one.
Yeah.
And sort of go sort of back to the drawing board, I guess.
Yeah, but I guess the distinction I want to make is that I think that's a benefit of just competition history and like the fact that inevitably you'll miss lifts. Yeah. And if you're like me, I've never gone 9 for 9, neither of you.
No, I haven't.
Yeah. Either. So that's a benefit of competition history, and more so than something that like I would deliberately expose my lifter to.
Yeah.
I've
got one more positive. I think for the coach, it gives us more data on sort of how good our lifter is at grinding through a load.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if let's say we take a 10 kilo jump from a, you know, relatively hard second to a third and they miss, we know next time that, you know, if their second looks the same as it did, take 7.5 next time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
so. I think that can help with attempt selection going forward. For the coach.
Yeah. But anyway, I think it's more turn a negative into a positive than like aim for what might be a negative.
Yeah.
Okay, my first question, I'll go for my first serious one. So these two are from Alex's client, Mags. I think she actually sent me like 4.
Shout out to Mags.
Shout out to Mags.
What a lady.
So let's do both of her questions in a row. The first one is best weight cutting methods for a comp.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says, what to do and what definitely not to do based on your own experience, and what's the most crazy and disgusting thing you did to cut the weight. So let's start with the best cutting methods for a comp. I've got like a pretty drawn out answer to this, so I'll give it in brief.
Yeah, you first.
Okay. So first things first, you need to establish how much weight you can actually cut in the short term for a comp. The best data, to the best of my knowledge, is that about a 4% body weight cut through dehydration is sort of the threshold at which there's measurable decreases in power sport performances. So no more than a 4% body weight cut in water, unless you think it's strategically valuable to lose a small amount of performance, but to actually weigh heavier. For the most part, I don't think that's the case. So no more than 4% in water, which means if you weigh more than, say you're an 83 kilo lifter, if you weigh more than 86, 87, you need to be cutting tissue weight. I don't think it's strategically a good time to cut tissue weight during your peak. We've spoken sort of briefly about why on other episodes. So that means it could be up to 12 to 16 weeks out, you're actually doing tissue weight, sort of body weight control until you're within water cutting range, holding steady. And then, yeah, doing a water cut. Your water cut should be done by over drinking and then over peeing if you're not going to manipulate food volume and things. Because, again, we have really good data showing that people who sweat out stuff, so if you go to the sauna, your prospects for rehydration are worse because your electrolyte balance is affected, or much more so than if you were to overdrink and pee out water. So basically,
do you want to explain why that is?
When you sweat, you lose electrolytes through the skin. That's the simple one. So basically, and like your kidneys actually work to conserve the appropriate amounts of potassium and sodium when you're peeing. So that's the super short answer. Basically, don't cut more than 4% of your body weight on the day. Do it mostly by water loading. You can literally water load by just drinking about twice your habitual intake, maybe even more, up until 14 to 16 hours out from comp. You can also do a tapered water load, though I don't necessarily think that's better. It does actually help with the retention of water once you start drinking again. But basically, drink about double your water intake, taper it back in the final 1 to 2 days, weigh in under, and then immediately drink some electrolyte-containing drinks and some saltier and starchy foods, and then continue to sip water from there. That's pretty much it. If you're doing anything more extreme than that, then you definitely want guidance. Alex?
What do you want me to elaborate on?
Well, just do you agree, basically?
I agree that water is probably the first thing that I would do. Water loading and then cutting it out very harshly, mm-hmm. probably 12 to 15 hours before weigh-in. And for most people, that's going to be overnight, so it's not too bad.
Yep.
There are additional things that you can do, such as tapering carbohydrate intake and tapering sodium intake, which I have done. And if you do them all in combination, it fucking sucks.
Yeah.
But you can lose like quite a little bit more.
Yep.
But then again, the performance decrease is going to be more with the more weight you lose.
Yeah.
So I guess you got to weigh in how much you need to cut and then use the variables that you need to get there.
So sodium and carbohydrate manipulation, I just want to jump in on very quickly. Sodium manipulation can certainly help. It can mess with your prospects of rehydration and performance on the day, but it can certainly help. Carbohydrate manipulation will help, as will manipulating food bulk, because for every gram of glycogen you store about 2 grams of water. So it can make a dramatic difference. However, if you are peaking correctly, because your training volume goes down, you'll have less muscular edema and less muscular glycogen because you won't be sort of super compensating in the same way as normal. So you should actually get a mild, like a smallish, maybe to the order of 1 kilo reduction in body weight purely from reducing your training volume. Cutting your carbohydrates arbitrarily is a bad idea. Not because you actually need a lot of carbohydrate for powerlifting performance on the day, but because carbohydrates, along with like sort of protein, total calories, and sleep, are really, really important for reducing fatigue. And when you're peaking and trying to perform at literally 100 to 105% of your base capabilities, you don't want to do anything that inhibits your recovery. So again, I consider that a far worse option than simple water manipulation. And so if you're doing extreme cuts, again, you have to have a very good basis for doing it, and it takes a lot more strategic planning than most people give it. Alex is nodding his head. So the more fun one is what not to do and what crazy disgusting things have you done to cut the weight. So I want to say I've never really had to do extreme weight cuts because I've always been pretty close to goal weight and never super overweight, but Alex has done a few pretty shitty ones.
My first competition, I did water loading and then a progressive taper in water. So yeah. I think I started the week at 10 liters and finished the week the day before at 1 liter, which is a bad idea.
I've done that as
and,
well.
And while doing that, my fats tapered up and my carbohydrates tapered down. My sodium tapered down at the same time. And I went to only liquid meals in the last 2 days. So the last 2 days, I only had 1 liter of water.
Yeah.
And I had only liquid calories.
How much weight did you actually lose?
I didn't actually lose that much. And that was the shit thing about it. Because, so dumb. Yeah, it was dumb. But I woke up the morning of the comp and I was 500 grams over.
Yeah.
So I started chewing and spitting.
Yep.
To spit out the rest of the weight through saliva. And I got to about 100 grams over before I left home, and I was sweet, I'll just leave it there. and I'll lose the rest just on the drive. I get to the venue and I'm 700 grams over on the corn scales. And bear in mind, this is my first competition, so I shouldn't have been doing this shit anyway. And I went completely to the extreme. So I had to continue chewing and spitting. I think about 30 minutes before weigh-in, I was chewing and spitting. Jumped on the comp scales for my official weigh-in. 200 grams over. Took my underwear off. Still 100 grams over.
Yeah.
Back to chewing and spitting. 15 minutes later, exactly at weight. Felt like completely drained, felt like shit. Had about 20 minutes to warm up for squats before I had to do my opener.
How'd you go?
6 for 9. Not good.
No, not great. If you're really interested in pretty crazy weight cuts for 2 hours, for like 2 hour weigh-ins, then JP at Fivetrong, John Paul Couchy on YouTube, has a video. It's pretty crazy. I remember being in Uzbekistan with him, with Alex, and the guy who was, I think, coaching him on the day, Simon Bergner, who's like one of the best blokes in powerlifting,
shout out Bergner.
Yeah, he was literally sitting with him in the sauna to help JP lose the final bit of weight. He was basically there on like, I don't know, suicide watch. Like, JP looked like a junkie. I remember going to visit him like 2 or 3 times over the course of a morning, and he just looked absolutely horrible. But yeah, if you want to see like something extreme, look at that. But I do have to reiterate, for the most part, I don't think it's even to your tactical advantage to try and do extreme weight cuts. So it's basically an indication that you fucked up elsewhere if you have to.
There's also another good video on YouTube. Yeah. Josh Hancock, you remember him?
Yeah.
AKA Josh Hanquit.
Can we not call out everybody?
He competed in Sydney actually at one of the expos a couple of years ago, and he like did a vlog of his last 48 hours or whatever and how he got to weight.
Yeah.
And it's interesting and it sucks.
All right. Mags's question number 2, again, shout out Mags, was what are your goals as a lifter and also as a powerlifting coach, and where would you like to see yourself in the future? Alex first.
As a lifter, I don't really have like concrete goals per se as far as numbers go. Like, I've got sort of short to medium term goals, like squat 250, bench 150, deadlift 300.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd like to do that before the end of next year, all of those, which I think is pretty reasonable. But as far as, like, a lifter goes, I just want to stay in powerlifting as long as I can without picking up any injuries, just consistently plugging away brick by brick. And as a coach, I think we had a discussion about this, actually.
Yeah.
It's not about, like, coaching someone to necessarily be the best lifter in the world, because like a lot of that comes down to chance and who like is gonna want you to coach them. Because, you know, it's not every day that someone with the genetic potential to be the best lifter in the world comes to you for coaching. But I think it's about sort of just like getting your lifters to consistently improve comp to comp, get them to hit their goals. And it's like the best feeling in the world for your lifter to come off the platform with a huge smile on their face after they've like put in all this work for months and months to get to where they were, and they're absolutely ecstatic with how they performed. And like you, Mags, how long ago was that? 4 weeks ago, when you came off the platform and gave me a big hug, that was like the best feeling in the world, and I'm sure you felt the same. So as a coach, I guess more creating more moments like that, more memories like that.
Yeah, I close to exactly agree with Alex. So goals as a lifter, I'm saying like I have short to medium term goals that are actually numerically really similar to Alex too. And long term, I just see training as something that I can plug away at and learn about myself and have fun and continue to develop. So no crazy goals as a lifter, just keep competing, keep having fun, keep learning. And I use my training as a vehicle to learn about myself, but also to learn lessons that I can apply in coaching other people. And as a coach, I'm again exactly on the same page as Alex. It's foster relationships, make people do well, make them enjoy what they do, and sort of share the positive experience basically that I've had with lifting with other people. And when I do get people who have talent, to sort of facilitate them achieving their goals is awesome too. But that's it. Alex, you got another question?
All right, this one's from Jackson Miles at JLM_training on Instagram. He's a 105 junior lifter from Australia, very good lifter. He asks, what assistance/accessory movements would you program for powerlifting if you're limited to only the use of a barbell? And I think this is for himself because he trains in his own garage. Have you seen his setup?
No.
It's fucking sick. He's got a combo rack with like a platform and a proper deadlift platform.
What, in his garage? In his
garage, yeah.
That's sick.
It's fucking sick.
Okay. You go.
I would break this down into sort of movement patterns first, and then sort of just fit exercises in.
Yeah, agreed. I actually think it's a really easy question, by the way.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
So, like, start with the squat. So, obviously, you have the competition squat, and then you would want to do high bar squat, front squat. And you could probably,
You could do split squats.
Yep.
You could do... That's two.
That's five.
Yeah, that's five already.
And then for, I guess, the posterior chain... RDLs, whatever, competition deadlift, then the reverse of that, competition deadlift. So if you pull sumo, some conventional. If you pull conventional, some sumo.
You can also do good mornings.
Deficits, good mornings. Yep.
You can use the barbell to give yourself like an assisted Nordic curl. You can also do bodyweight stuff, so you could still do bodyweight Nordic curls. That's, again, enough probably for the deadlift.
Yep. For the bench, I guess... bench, close grip bench, mid grip bench,
floor press,
spotto bench,
incline bench, overhead press, incline bench,
yeah, etc., etc. And then I guess for the back, and then I guess the arms.
Yeah, so back you can do pull ups, you can do bent over rows. You can actually, with a barbell, you can jam it in a corner and make yourself like a landmine setup. Mm-hmm. So that means you can do landmine presses and landmine rows and meadows rows. So that's a whole stack of things already.
Like a T-bar row.
Yeah, so you really only need... you only need like one to two vertical and horizontal rows. So if you're doing pull-ups and chin-ups, then you've got a couple of horizontal rows there as well. And then what else we got? Arms, barbell curls, JM press.
Skull crushers.
Yeah.
French press.
Yeah, and you could do like upright rows to the nipple if you want some shoulder and trap gains. And yeah, abs, you can do bodyweight ab stuff all day. So I don't consider that hugely limiting, to be honest. No. You're limited only by your creativity and your patience.
And then within all of those exercises, you can change things like tempos and emphases and stuff like that.
Yeah. Loads, rest periods, reps.
Yeah. There's a million things you can do
with
not much.
Yeah. Cool. All right. That was a good question, though. I'll ask my next one.
Ask your next one and then we'll do a sick musical break.
All right, yeah. Okay, we've got a quick fire bunch from Jules Nannetti, who you can find on Instagram at Jules Nannetti.
And episode 3 of the podcast.
Yeah, and episode... was it 3?
Yeah,
3. Okay. Okay. She's actually sent like 1,000 questions. Quick fire. Who would win in a fight to the death? 3, 2, 1, me. would you rather not wash your hands or not wash your face for a year? You go first. 3, 2, 1.
Hands.
3, 2, 1. Face. 100% face.
You'd not wash your face.
Yeah, because you'd die of like cholera if you didn't wash your hands. Your face just gonna be dirty. Go for a swim. Easy.
Go for a swim. Same thing.
No, not the same, because you want to wash your hands before you eat, you grub. You know how much poo you got under your fingers?
Probably quite a lot.
Okay, if you're able to live to the age of 90 and retain either the mind or body of a 30-year-old for the last 60 years of your life, which would you want?
I would maintain the body.
Absolutely the body. Mm. I feel like my mental acuity is only going to go up until it like drastically falls, but my body's already pretty beat, so I don't really want to be 90.
And I'm really dumb, so like, it's whatevs.
Yeah, whatever. If you could wake up tomorrow having gained any one quality or ability, what would it be? Supernatural ability, flying, 100% would be so good.
Flying would be good.
Time travel. Time travel would be useful. Otherwise, what quality or ability? I reckon, I don't know, like, it'd be awesome to just be an absolute master of something fun, like being an incredible, like, world-class surfer or an incredibly good musician. Both of them would be really good fun. But yeah, otherwise, just flying for sure.
I thought you were going to say bench press.
No, I'm fine with how I am. All right. If you knew that in 1 year you would die suddenly, would you change anything about the way you are now living and why?
Jesus. That's pretty grim. That's grim, Jules. I guess, like, from a training perspective, I'd probably train a lot harder. If I knew that I only had a year to be the best that I was ever going to be, probably go pretty ham on training.
You reckon? I reckon I'd train less. Like, I like training, but I'm in it for the long haul. I'd probably go to the gym literally enough to satisfy my desire to go to the gym, which might be 4 days a week hard, and I deadlift every day. But no, in my actual life, to be honest, I'd probably be inclined to either spend more time doing things that I just consider like fun, you know, stuff like, yeah, surfing, playing music, like hanging with my friends, much more inclined to do that. And then in my time not doing that, I do a lot more things that I feel like are giving back. I know that sounds, that's so like virtue signally, but I actually really enjoy doing things that contribute to a community. So I'd probably volunteer more, yeah, like write articles, do podcasts, just do stuff like that. So I was like making a bit of a legacy. And then
good guy Burke.
Good guy Burke. But then, yeah, I'd cock it very suddenly.
The Weekly Weights Foundation.
The Weekly Weights Foundation. All right, Jules's final question. God, this is a hard one. She said, what are your five favorite books of all time? Alex.
I don't read, so I don't have a five. Yeah, I don't think I've ever read five books.
Spot Goes to the Park. Maybe Tashi, 1 through 5.
Harry Potter, 1 through 5.
Didn't finish the 6th and 7th. Yeah, I found this one really hard. Unlike Alex, I do read. In fact, I have to read a book to go to sleep every night. So, like, I'm talking like I'll get home blind drunk and read.
Really?
Yeah, 100%. And then I just forget what happens and I reread it the next day. That's good.
That's retarded.
So there were 3 books that immediately came to mind, and then I'm not sure. So number 1 is The Spy Who Came In From the Cold by John le Carré, or John le Carré. Don't know how to say it properly. He's written a whole bunch of really good books. It's a spy novel, but it's got like a moral. It's really good. Number 2 is a book by a guy called Joe Abercrombie called The Heroes. Which is one of, I think, 6 books that he's written in sort of like a fantasy world. But this one, it's again a book with a moral. It's basically about war and how nobody wins. And it's just great. Like, it's really funny. There's lots of dramatic irony. The characters are great. It's just a really good book. And you basically read it and it makes you think and it makes you laugh. And then the third one, this is a series. It's called His Dark Materials. And the first book is called The Northern Lights. And it's a young adult series of books that I just remember reading when I was younger so many times. And yeah, it's weird. It's about a little girl who has parents who basically hate each other. But then her dad starts a war with God. Sounds strange, but she basically ends up like traveling, you know, all over the world and between worlds and trying to sort of, it's like a coming of age story. And she's trying to basically resolve all these conflicts in her life and learn who she is. And it's just like, just incredible book and or books. And that's by Philip Pullman. So those were the 3 that like I immediately thought of. And then after that, I don't know, Great Expectations, Moby Dick, like, you know, Harry Potter. Not Harry Potter. I didn't really rate Harry Potter that highly, to be honest, after about the 4th book. But yeah, I just like books. Read lots. You know? Yeah. All right, quick break. Alex is like shaking his head. He's disgusted. We'll be back.
Welcome back to Weekly Weights. We are here with the Q&A. We'll take it away.
All right. This question is from Trinity, who trains here at Lift Performance Centre. You can find her on Instagram at chinuptraining. That's one word. She says, obviously, you guys talk predominantly about the actual sport of powerlifting. I like that she capitalized sport of powerlifting. As well as, but not exclusively, simply doing powerlifting movements in training. What are some of the other benefits of doing those major lifts when it comes to, say, somebody like me who does weightlifting, i.e. is there much point doing things like bench, and is it valid to do them to sort of maintain absolute strength? So there's a few questions in there. Basically, what are the values of doing those major lifts for other sports, specifically weightlifting, and then we'll talk about bench and absolute strength training too. So starting with, is there value? Alex.
Yes, there is value for weightlifters to do powerlifting stuff. You're going to build a general base of strength by doing powerlifting, and not making your training so specific can help you avoid staleness and avoid injury, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I kind of disagree with you actually, and I'm gonna explain why. Is there value to doing powerlifting stuff? Yes, in a very limited sense. However, the powerlifts themselves have the ability to interfere a little bit with weightlifting, so. Some people argued for using the low bar squat to develop weightlifters specifically for the clean because it sort of mimics the position of the first pull, but the majority of weightlifting coaches agree that it's not necessarily beneficial to squat low bar, and it's also probably disproportionately fatiguing to do low bar squats. So I think training for strength in the high bar squat, which mimics the catching position, is a better idea.
I agree with that.
I agree with that. bench press. Look, the Chinese weightlifting team at the moment do bodybuilding work and do include the bench press to develop shoulder strength, so there's probably a degree to which it's helpful, but doing too much bench press is probably unhelpful because it doesn't really transfer to the jerk. The jerk's much more of like a full body power movement. You don't need much chest strength, and having like overdeveloped and over tightened pecs and triceps actually would worsen your overhead position, so doing too much bench is, I don't think, a good idea. Alex?
I think the context I was coming from was sort of like a general pop weightlifter, sort of like
as opposed to
someone who's like very competitive.
Okay, in that like in that respect, if you just want to vaguely be strong and like do a bit of weightlifting, do a bit of powerlifting, then yeah, totally. I think there's crossover. If you're trying to get good at weightlifting specifically, I don't think powerlifts.
I think in the early stages of like someone who wants to be a good weightlifter, I think in the early stages it's good to sort of develop like barbell strength as a whole before specializing.
Sure, but I would say barbell strength should be, if you want to be a weightlifter, do high bar squats, do front squats.
Oh, yeah.
Do overhead press, do push press, maybe do some like push-ups, weighted push-ups, do some bench.
I don't think the low bar squat for weightlifters is a good idea.
Yeah.
Because of shoulder health issues.
Yeah, and just the absolute loads.
Yeah, it's not necessary.
And then the final powerlift is the deadlift. I don't think weightlifters should do deadlifting in a powerlifting manner. I think all of your pulls should be clean or snatch pulls, which are positionally different. And you should be trying to maintain thoracic extension and having your shoulders slightly ahead of the bar. And you should probably be pulling in your weightlifting shoes. I think the deadlift in powerlifting is similar enough to your weightlifting pull that it will interfere, and it's massively fatiguing for not a huge amount of benefit. And this ties into an answer to Trinity's third question, which is it valid to do them to maintain absolute strength? Weightlifting isn't actually an absolute strength sport. It's important to be strong, and the best weightlifters are certainly really strong, but training for absolute strength itself past a point, like past a reasonable point of development, probably doesn't give you the best trade-off, and what limits you is technique and speed, or speed power, I should say. So most of your training should be sort of in the speed power ranges. So if you're doing strength work, it's probably in a more like sort of, you know, 65 to 80% range, done quickly with lots of reps in reserve in movements that mimic the weightlifting movements, as opposed to limit strength, slow stuff like powerlifting.
Would you say that powerlifting, like doing lots of very hard sets of one or two or three or whatever, would actually slow down a weightlifter? Would you say that they're teaching you to be slow?
I'm not sure, honestly. And I can't say for certain that it would slow you down, but it wouldn't speed you up.
Because I've noticed for sure, like back when I used to play basketball and rugby, like I was quite quick and like explosive.
Yeah.
And now I've lost a lot of that.
Yeah, but I would say
whether that's because I've been training for powerlifting or because I'm a lot heavier now, I don't know.
Look, I don't think it's training for powerlifting. I think it's the absence of fast training. So, in fact, one of the reasons that the powerlifts are really sort of bad as sole means to develop speed and explosive strength is because you have to decelerate at the end of the motion. So, say when you bench, you don't throw the bar, you finish your bench. When you squat, you don't jump, you stand at the top of your squat. And so, movements like the weightlifts, where they are really like throws, you know, and things like throwing a javelin or a shot put, doing jumps. That's what actually gets you fast and explosive. You just need to have a baseline of absolute strength and muscularity. So to sort of answer all the questions in a really roundabout way, doing some type of sort of, strength work and maybe a tiny bit of absolute strength work here and there, helpful definitely for weightlifters and recreational lifters, but it needs to be specific to weightlifting. And so the use of the actual power lifts, I think, should be really probably limited and strategic.
So strategic to the early phases of a prep or the early phases of like a career?
I think both. I think if you're Ilya Ilyin, then you're almost certainly not low bar squatting or bench pressing.
Well, I mean, no one should be low bar, no weightlifter should be low bar squatting, in my opinion.
I mean, I tend to agree. I'm not a weightlifting coach, so I think I've pretty clearly articulated what I think and why. But I'm also willing to entertain the fact that I might be wrong. It's just, that's what I think.
Yes. Cool. All right, next question.
Yeah, you go first.
All right, this is from Aiden Potts. You can find him on Instagram at Potsteria Chain.
That's one of the best pun names for somebody, by the way.
Yeah, I came up with it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
He wanted to do Potsteria Gains, and I was like, nah, that's not as good.
No, it's not.
Do Potsteria Chain.
Okay, good on you, both Aiden and Alex.
He says, since the uprising participation and popularity of powerlifting, for juniors in particular, what do you think the longevity is like for those in the sport who are looking for fast results through their training?
How did he originally ask that?
Let me find it.
So I feel like that's a really sanitized version of what he initially said.
What he actually wants to hear.
What he actually wants us to hear is something like, can you call out...
Hang on. Here we go. Actually talk about these young cunts who are arrogant and need to pull their fucking heads in.
All right, Potsy. You rage up. So what was the question? People who are after fast results as opposed to longevity? Or
no, he asked, what is the longevity like for someone who is after fast results? And he prefaced that with juniors in particular.
So young cunts who need to pull their heads in.
So we've actually seen this, like, I've seen this since I started competing.
Yeah.
That the juniors are always after, like, the best total that they can possibly do as a junior, and they always go higher than they need to in their last junior year and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And we've seen that, like, you know, I mean...
I did the same.
Yeah, we did the same. So what do you think?
Okay,
What do you think the trend... What do you think the trend is in juniors?
Okay, I think the trend for juniors... Actually, you know what? It's really patronizing for me to say that they think they're more important than they are. Because when you're competing, if you're a competitor, then you have every reason to try and be as good as you can be. And so as a junior, if you're competing against juniors, you should absolutely be trying to be the best you can. However, I think with an eye on long-term development, people need to also basically just develop a love for training that is not bound purely by their competition results. And they need to contextualize... like their achievement versus basically the rest of the world. There is a huge step up from juniors to opens, and if you're only in powerlifting for the fact that you get to stomp on kids who are 5 years younger than you and like still finishing puberty when you're 22, then you're gonna hate it when you are suddenly 23 years old and have to compete against people who are 30, 35 and are really great. And so I think your first focus should be on developing sound technique and just enjoying training. And let the fact that you might be really good and really competitive almost be incidental for that. And then absolutely, when you go to competitions, try and win and try and smash everybody and take pride in what you do. But I don't, like, I think there is an overemphasis on basically trying to almost take advantage of the fact that you are in the final years of your juniors, hugely advantaged over the people you're competing against who are early in their journey. And that overemphasis on it and overemphasis on the fact that you can do really well also leads you to a huge disappointment when that's suddenly taken away.
I think my opinion on this is that a lot of these guys and girls sort of push themselves as if the end of their juniors is the finish line.
Yeah.
When in reality, like, if we use the analogy of a running race, powerlifting genuinely is a marathon. And if you're treating it like a 400-meter race or a 200-meter race, you are going to burn out. Like, you can't run a marathon the way you run 100 meter or 200 meter sprint.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to burn out. And, like, trying to hit all these rep PBs every week on every lift, it's just not sustainable. You're going to hurt yourself, or your progress is going to stall completely. Like,
yeah.
If you want to be in this, if you want to be in this for the long haul, that is how you're going to be the best. If you really want to be the best at powerlifting, you have to do this for 10 to 15 to 20 years. And if you sprint the first 2 years, you won't last.
Yeah, I can agree with that. And I think, like, errors that I see quite commonly are things like people who say, look, I'm 7 kilos above my weight class, you know, like I weigh 81 kilos, but, you know, I can cut to 74 and, you know, I'm going to do that twice a year so that I can go to nationals and, you know, come second at nationals as a junior, because if I went to the 83s, I'd come fifth or sixth. And so they're so caught up in a short-term, you know, medal that might not even be gold, that they do things that are training off their long-term development. And I think that's a mistake. And yeah, again, it leaves them to be in a particularly disappointing place when they step up. And otherwise, yeah, I do broadly agree with Alex. I think just smashing yourself into the ground for short-term progress is, yeah, not a good idea if you're trying to set yourself up to be around for a long time.
Especially when that short-term progress is just beating up on a bunch of kids who are less than 23.
Yeah.
It's like really not that impressive.
Yeah. And I also just think, like, as somebody who's like a fan of the sport, I think it's a shame when there are people who are extraordinarily talented. Like, I remember as a junior looking at some of the people I was competing against and just thinking, like, oh my God, like, how can these people exist? And half of them aren't in the sport anymore. And it sucks because, you know, they were way better than me then and they would probably be way better than me now. And I think it's really good for powerlifting to have the standard of competition be high. So again, just as somebody who likes the sport, if you think you can be great, then work on being the greatest you can be, not the greatest you can necessarily be tomorrow.
Mm.
I
think another thing is chasing sub-junior and junior records as well.
Yeah.
Like, no one gives a fuck.
Yeah, that was the thing that I refrained from saying because I think it's patronizing.
No one cares about your sub-junior record.
Like,
someone's going to take it in a year anyway.
I've said that before, and I do to some degree believe that, but the reason I say it's patronizing is because I think it's like you should be proud of the things you do. And when you're there, like if you're competing among, I mean, fuck, if you're a sub junior, you're competing amongst like two people.
You're on your own, yeah.
Yeah, but if you're a junior, like you might be, there was like 20 83s when I did my last junior nationals.
Yeah.
One sec.
They weren't knocking.
Okay, yeah. If you're a junior, you're competing against like 20 other people. I think people do care. If you get a medal or if you get a record, you care. The people you're competing against care, but you got to sort of put that in the context of the fact that like it's still the junior world record. It's not like you're the best under 23, but there's a big, big.
Oh, I wasn't talking about world records. I'm talking about Australian records.
Well, same logic. You know, the people who are there care, and the people you're competing against care. But you just got to be able to put it in a bit of context and not let your head get too inflated by something that's. Maybe it's not a small fry achievement. I've never held one, but it's certainly not like, you know, your Neil Armstrong.
And the other thing is, like we said before, these juniors are often sprinting to the end of their junior years. Some of these people that we've seen are chasing records that are so far away. Like, in order for them to get there, they're like destroying themselves just to get this one number. When you know, maybe in 5 years' time, they could get 20 or 30 kilos more than that if they just, you know, took their time and trained smart.
Yeah.
And because of these things, like people pushing themselves way, way, way too hard, they're pushing their sets to, you know, RPE 10s every session. They're pushing their sets to RPE 10. Their technique is falling apart. They're teaching themselves to lift badly, and then they're developing bad habits going forward. And that's one of the things that Will and I like to emphasize early on in a career. And if you're a junior, you are early on in your career. You need to lift efficiently and you need to try and lift the same way every time. And if you're sacrificing that just to hit a rep PB on a squat that looks cool for Instagram, like, what's the point?
Yeah, I can agree with that. Okay, I think we've pretty well hashed that out. Let's move on to a question. I don't know if I should name this person just because it's got to do with illicit drugs. So yeah, like, I'll preserve his anonymity, but he asks, can you do a podcast on cocaine and training? Thanks.
I have no experience in this.
Yeah, also.
No comment.
Also no experience in this, though. Wasn't there that dude in the UFC who was busted for using cocaine, like, before one of his fights or something?
Wasn't someone in, like, Australian sport doing this recently?
Wendell Saylor.
Yeah,
that's not that recent. Wendell Saylor's, like, 15 years ago. Or, like, every NRL player ever.
he had to say, like, he was obviously using it recreationally.
Yeah.
But if he pleaded that he was using it as a performance enhancer, he only got a 12-month ban versus a 24-month ban from the sport or something like that.
Really?
So he said that he used it, like...
No, that wasn't Wendell, surely.
Wasn't that?
No.
Who was that?
Oh, I don't know. That's silly, but...
Anyway, someone pleaded that they were using cocaine pre-game to get 12 months off their ban.
I do remember reading a very interesting article, actually, about, like, the potential use of cocaine as a performance enhancer. Like... Because it is a stimulant and it, you know, narrows your focus and it makes you more aggressive or something. But yeah, in all honesty, don't know. And as a health professional, I obviously can't advocate for the use of cocaine. I suppose if you used cocaine, you'd train better the next day than if you got absolutely blind, but like you just wouldn't sleep. So Yeah, pros and cons, mostly cons. Major con being going to jail. Okay. So anyway, anonymous, there's an answer to your question. One more.
I got one.
Okay, you got one. One more and then a break.
All right. Nenad. So this guy doesn't have a name on Instagram, but it's NENAD dot underscore underscore. If you want to follow him, but he's on private. He says, four deloads. Which one is more optimal slash preferred? Number one, reducing the amount of weight and volume, or number two, keeping the same weight you performed the week before but reducing the amount of volume?
I'm going to give him the Eric Helms. It depends.
On?
A few things, but I'm going to give a really short answer. I'm actually curious for your thoughts on this. So when you're doing a hypertrophy phase, the majority of your training stress, in inverted commas, is from higher volumes because your intensities are probably in like the 60 to 80% range. And yeah, your volumes are quite high. So in that instance, you've got sort of like a lot of intensity headroom. You probably don't need to cut much of that, but reducing your volume quite drastically is going to help you recover a lot more. Like if you're doing 120 sets or 160 sets per 160 reps per week of bench press, say, in a hypertrophy phase, that's a stupid amount.
That's a lot.
But if you're doing all that at 60%, doing that instead at 55% or 45% isn't going to reduce stress, but dropping that down dramatically will.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, there's no reason to think that you're going to lose any muscle or detrain in a week by dropping your volume drastically. So hypertrophy phases, your deload should certainly involve a reduction in volume. Easiest way to do that is to drop your set volume to half or two thirds or three quarters of what you normally do, and drop your reps as well to take you further from failure. So again, I would usually drop rep numbers by between sort of 25% and 40%.
So like let's say you're doing a 4x10,
yeah,
with 80 kilos. You might then for the deload week do 2x8 with 80 kilos.
Yeah, 2x8 with 80, maybe 75, but like very mild intensity reduction. And pretty much the reverse is true with strength phases. So strength phases, the volume stress is not enormously high, but because the intensity is up, it still accumulates quite a lot. You have quite a lot of volume headroom, not a lot of intensity headroom, so I would drop your intensity more. You might preserve some early in the week, but then drop it more and drop your volume only less. So say you're doing a 4x5 at 80%, you might on your deload week do a 3x5 or a 3x4 at, you know, 60 is aggressive, but you know, like 60 to 70%. And again, that's subject to your needs. If you haven't accumulated as much fatigue, or you are somebody who dissipates fatigue quickly, you might preserve intensity and drop volume early in a deload week for a strength phase and then drop the volume later. Or, you know, if your weights are ramping up quite significantly in your next block, you might maintain intensity a little higher but drop volume very drastically. So again, you've still got heaps of reps in reserve. But basically, you just need to consider the overall training stress and where you can reduce it while still preserving the adaptations you're after. And for the most part, it's sort of, it just changes on the phase you're in. Alex is pretty much nodding his head, so.
Yeah, so I think to reiterate what you said, in a volume block, if you require a deload, most of that reduction in stress should come from volume.
Yes.
If you're in a strength or an intensity block, most of the reduction in stress should come from intensity. So like I like to use 50% reduction in volume in a volume block as a deload.
Sure.
And for an intensity block, I like to reduce intensity by 20%.
Yep.
And volume by 20%.
Yep. And I'll just say as well, I sometimes, if I have athletes training 5 days a week, sometimes I'll make their deloads 4 days a week. And that, just having the extra day off as well, helps them quite a bit too.
Another thing that I do is cut out some exercises.
Yeah, because there's some things like you're not going to miss bicep curls for a week, like, and it gets you out of the gym faster. And then, you know, if you're doing two rowing exercises in a day, you can just drop to one. Mm-hmm. And instead of doing four sets of one and two of the other, you just do three sets of one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, final extremely quick question. Well, it could be a very long question. This is from Loco.McD, who does our theme music. He asks, why do you exist? That's my question. Alex.
Me?
Why do you exist?
That's how deep are we going to get on this?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a bit existential.
Why do I exist? Or I guess why do I exist? I don't.
People have been asking.
I don't know why I exist, Loco.
To be honest,
I exist to listen to your awesome theme music.
Yeah, I exist to listen to Loco's awesome theme music and his band Wolves in Fashion, and his other band that are a covers band, DCL.
Do they have any gigs coming up, Will?
Wolves in Fashion, I'm not certain. DCL played last Sunday, and usually play about once a month at the Public in Camera. Loco also plays saxophone and has a company, acts such as Pliny. Yeah, why do you exist? Don't know, but you know, I think therefore I am, so I can tell you for certain that I exist, but that's all that I can tell you.
Very good, Bill.
All right, let's
break.
Weekly Waits. Welcome back. Q&A episode, Weekly Waits. I'm Will, with Miss Alex. I have more questions from Mags, MagsW1978 on Instagram. She says, "Hi Will, I have a couple more." She says, "As a coach yourself, do you always listen to your coach and follow the program, even if you disagree with something and that you think that he is wrong?" Alex, take it away. Fess up to JP.
Hi JP, I know you're listening. Do I always listen to my coach? Yes. Do I always agree? Not always. But if I don't agree, I'll generally ask for a justification. And then usually because I am a coach myself, it's easier for me to have a discussion with whoever is coaching me. And we sort of like hash it out and talk about like this and that and why. And then generally, 99% of the time, we will agree on whatever it is. So I guess the short answer is yes.
Yeah. So here's just a good way to think about it for everybody. And this is going to lead into the next question. Your coach generally has your best interests at heart. And unless they're shit, they've done some type of planning to specifically manipulate training variables to try and get you better down the track. So you should be following your program and giving your coach feedback all the time, because two things can happen. Either you do the program and it works, in which case, great, your coach's decisions are vindicated. Or you do the program and it doesn't work and it doesn't get the result you want. And then your coach has valuable information with which they can update your plans. Because what happens the longer you work with somebody is you work from a sort of general concept of what you think you need to do to get them stronger to a more specific one. So a good example, Alex was talking to me about one of his clients just the other day, and she was saying she needs to squat 3 times a week, but none of them can be on consecutive days, and she needs to bench, and 2 of those days, like 4 days a week or something, and 2 need to be hard, and all this stuff. But this is all information that he was able to gather because that particular client does her programs day in, day out, and gives Alex feedback. So even if you don't necessarily agree with the programming decision, it is in your best long-term interests to try it, give it an honest crack, and get back to your coach, because either they're going to be right, in which case, suck it, or they're going to change the programming long-term to suit you better. And if you change things, and particularly if you change things and don't tell your coach, then their future training decisions, which will be informed by your results, they're not going to have a firm basis in fact. And so I've had times, like I'm currently writing my own programs, or actually at the moment, Luke from Lift Performance Center is writing my program because I'm rehabbing a sore back. But I've been writing my own powerlifting programs for a while. But I had times when I was working with Amir where he wanted me to do stuff that I didn't want to do or I disagreed. And, you know, like Alex said, I would write to him and say, you know, oh, I'm not so sure about this, X, Y, and Z. Get a justification, and I would either agree to it and just give it a wholehearted crack for the 3 or 4 weeks of that block, or he would change it, but he was able to actually update his planning. Whereas if I'd just gone in and said, nah, you know, pin benches are stupid and they don't help and they hurt my elbows, so I'm just not going to do them, or I'm not going to actually pause my squats for long enough, or whatever it happens to be, then all that does is muddy the waters. Alex?
I think on your point about sort of changing the program and then not communicating the change.
Yeah.
Your results are then not indicative of your coach's program.
100%.
So if coach gives you a program and says do 4 sets of 5 in squats and at 75 kilos and you do 4 sets of 5 in squats at 85 kilos and you hurt your back, that's your fault, not your coach's fault.
Yeah.
If you, the same scenario, you do your 4 sets of 5 at 85 kilos and your squat doesn't improve, that is then not indicative of your coach wanting you to do that.
Yes.
Essentially.
Yeah. So yeah, basically, I think it's in your best interest to always follow your program, do what you're told, because if your coach doesn't modify your program in light of unsuccessful trials, then they're a shit coach. And if they're a good coach, they're going to, and you're going to get closer and closer to a sort of optimal training program by actually doing that. And training is an iterative process, or learning is an iterative process. And Alex is looking at me funny. That word means that you go through repeated efforts to try and improve it. Basically, you don't get the perfect program off the bat. You get perfect programming and coaching through continual investment and refinement.
One of the things that I do with my clients, when I send them their program, I ask if they have any thoughts or if they have any questions.
Yes.
And I usually will give them like a little bit of a summary, like, okay, going to this block, we're now 6 weeks out and we're going to do X and Y, intensity is going to come up, blah, 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 this and that. And then ask them if they have any thoughts. And then we sort of discuss it before the block starts to avoid any confusion going forward.
Yeah. So I also send my clients their programs on either the Friday or the Saturday if they're going to start it on the following Monday. Same thing. Say, read this, hit me with questions. There's always an instructions thing. It might only be a paragraph long at the start of each program, but I always say, read them and get back to me, because there's nothing worse than opening my phone, you know, like say in a morning when I've gone to sleep at night and I have a training update from somebody the night before saying, oh, I didn't know what I was going to do for X and Y. It annoys me to death because, you know, as a coach, I want to facilitate you doing things right. So basically, communicate and do your program. The next question we've almost answered in this is, what makes a perfect client and what qualities does she slash he need to have to become the best lifter that they can? Alex.
I think the first thing is open communication.
Yeah.
So being able to essentially be on a level playing field. Like the coach is, I guess, in charge of you, your boss per se, but there can be discussion back and forth. So if something is going badly, tell them. If something is going well, tell them. If something is harder than they were expecting, tell them. Because if they don't know, they can't do anything about it. And if you don't communicate, the coach will assume that everything is going well.
I agree with Alex entirely. I also wrote an article about this. I'm going to plug myself. Yeah, so there's...
I don't read.
Yeah, Alex doesn't read. So on my website, which is willberkman.com, under the blog section, there's one called Attitude Lessons from High-Level Lifters and How to Make the Most Out of Coaching. Read that. Comment on it or share it or whatever, please. But yeah, what Alex said is exactly true. Other important attributes are just like humility and willing to listen, and also like a sort of, to a degree, a mental and emotional investment in your training, because you should be using training as a learning process. It's very important for you to go in sort of day by day and actually be thinking, what can I do to improve today? What has my coach asked me to do? So just being diligent in actually sort of checking what are you going to try and do technically or in terms of execution on a day by day basis are important. Yeah, open communication and trust and patience.
I got one more.
Yeah.
Or did you have more?
No, that's it. You can.
Okay. I was going to say having an open mind.
Yes.
So like Will was saying before, the coach has the lifter's best interest at heart. If they're asking you to do something that, you know, might seem a little bit strange to you, they're not trying to get you worse.
Yeah.
Like, they are trying to help you improve. So if it seems strange to you, like, have an open mind, try it out, just like what you were saying before. If you disagree with it, give it an honest crack, try it out. If it doesn't work, then fine.
Yeah.
But if it does, great.
And then I guess it's then incumbent on the coach to actually respect the athlete's feedback, because particularly with remote coaching, so online coaching, you can't be there, you can't necessarily observe what you want to, so you need to communicate what feedback you want from the athlete and, you know, what constitutes good and bad performance. And then, yeah, respect the fact that when the athlete gives you feedback, they're also interested in getting better, so you do need to be able to justify why you do the things that you do, and you do need to be able to take into account their feedback. And sometimes it is important to just sort of throw people a bone and give them stuff that they enjoy that they're going to, yeah, leap into just to keep them training hot. You got any more thoughts on that? Or okay, cool. Alex, next question.
All right, so this one is from M Wizfit.
Okay.
So M underscore WIZZ Fit on Instagram. She messaged me with not a question, but then worded it into a question. She said she trains for enjoyment and to reach her goals, but she doesn't want to do so at the detriment of her own long-term health. So she asking basically, is powerlifting more detrimental for ligament / muscle / joint health than other forms of weight training?
Yes and no. I think as a realist, I have to say that lifting absolute maximum loads and training extremely hard very long term is a risk for injury to ligaments and tendons and muscles. But intelligent training, appropriate rest, and not developing loads, not developing loads too fast, and good technique can all mitigate that risk really severely. And when you do that, I don't think powerlifting is inherently a lot riskier than bodybuilding. And I do think as well that there's good data to show that the injury rate in powerlifting is actually relatively low if you class injuries as acute injuries. Like, it's much less dangerous than any of the football codes, for instance. But if you classify injury, there was a study done in Sweden on powerlifters, like elite and sub-elite powerlifters. If you classify injury as sort of niggles, then the amount of injuries you're likely to have as a powerlifter are higher. But again, I think that's largely mitigable by doing things intelligently. I can give like a longer, more academic response, but basically, is it a risk? Yes. Does it have to be a long-term risk? Not necessarily if you're smart. The question is, are you smart?
Yeah, I think if you train with good technique and you use phasic structure in your programming to sort of have periods of time where you're not training at higher intensity and have periods of time where you are training at a higher intensity and you don't train high intense all the time, I think you'll be better off than if you do. Mm. Obviously, when you get closer to a competition, your joints are going to get more beat up because the loads that you're lifting are heavier, and you're more likely to fall out of your groove in your technique, so you're more likely to tweak something. That's just inevitable in powerlifting.
Yeah.
But if you have good technique first and then you use sort of the right progression in terms of loading, you'll definitely mitigate risk.
Yeah, and I do want to jump in as well and say, although I said long term it's probably a risk, like just being realistic, most high level powerlifters have had some injuries and carry some niggles. I don't want to sort of exclude the middle and therefore make people think that powerlifting is unsafe, and I think we've done a good job in saying that. But at the very far end of the spectrum is not training at all, or not trying to get stronger, or doing training that's useless bullshit, that's not hard. And all of those carry far, far more long-term health risk than investing yourself in a sport that focuses on continued intelligent development of muscularity and strength. And progressive loading done intelligently is also the most powerful way of improving soft tissue strength and bone mineral density and muscular strength. And muscular strength is also one of the strongest correlates we have for older people and all-cause mortality. So in terms of preserving physical function, you should really be thinking of how can I get strong progressively and safely through long ranges of movement, in big movements, in lots of planes, and keep doing that for a long time. And if you think about it, powerlifting training, particularly done intelligently and with sufficient sort of variety in phasic structure, is possibly one of the healthiest things you can do, just maybe not at the absolutely elite level. Alex?
You brought this up earlier with injury risk in comparison to other sports.
Yes.
So a lot of the reason for that is the unpredictability of the other sports.
Yes.
So something like basketball, for instance, we don't know where the ball's going to end up. We don't know where every other nine player on the court is going to be, etc., etc. We could roll our ankle at any moment.
Yeah.
Rugby, for instance, you can run into someone's shoulder and get a concussion immediately at any moment.
Yeah.
In powerlifting, you're actually penalized for moving. So the chance of something happening outside of bad technique or just general wear and tear is very low.
Yeah, and I do think also because it's a static sport in a controlled environment, you really do also have the chance to say, wow, my shoulder hurts a bit today, or like my pec's a bit sore, and say, I'm not going to go try and bench press a PB and ergo not strain your pec. You do actually have the chance to do that. So again, if injury risk is your chief concern and you plan around that, then there's every reason powerlifting can be good for longevity. Just be intelligent.
And the other thing about powerlifting is it's not a team game into an individual game. So you're not letting down a team by deciding to step away.
Yeah.
You are being smart for yourself because you are the only person on your team.
Yeah. Okay. I think we've covered that enough to at least help you form an opinion. A question that really follows from that is by our friend Omar Jan, who is on Instagram as Omi, O-M-I-E, J-J-A-Y. That's all one word, Omi J. He says, maintaining healthy... Well, it's not really a question, Omar. Maintaining healthy joints doing during powerlifting prep, sad emoji, okay emoji. Knees, elbows, shoulders. All right, Alex.
So I think he's asking how we can best maintain healthy joints during prep. Okay, so like we were saying before, it is inevitable you're going to get niggles when loads get heavy. I think the first thing that you can do is lift with sound technique, like we were saying before.
Yes.
If you have bad technique and you have inconsistent technique, you're going to be more likely to niggle something. As far as maintaining healthy joints, I think stuff like massage, making sure you warm up correctly,
prehab
work that you need to do that is specific to your whatever case it is. So don't just go in and do a bunch of foam rolling and do a bunch of random activation exercises if they're not specific to what the problem that you have is. So essentially know what you need to do in order to get yourself moving correctly and healthily, and do that. And outside of that, just lift well and within your means. Another thing that we speak about all the time is fatigue management. If you are training heavy all the time, you're not giving your joints a break. So you need to make sure that you have heavy days and planned lighter days and space your heavy and light days out so that you are ready for your heavy day next time. If you're only doing heavy days, you're more likely to hurt yourself.
Yeah, I agree entirely with Alex. Things that are less likely to help but probably still have some mild benefit would be some active recovery. And in order for active recovery not to interfere with your training, it needs to be really easy. So things like going for a nice slow walk on the beach, or which is beautiful. It's also something I like to do. Long slow walks on the beach. That, or going for a slow swim, stuff like that, just keeping yourself moving can help. And then, yeah, probably weak evidence for things for like joint health supplements and omega-3s. But like broadly speaking, I guess you could say that having a healthy diet helps. But I say that very tentatively and in like it's going to make much less of a difference than just training intelligently and with good technique. And then don't do too many successive preps and don't start prep if you've got heaps of niggles that you don't think you're going to be able to overcome.
Yeah, don't do 5 comps a year if you're always hurt during comp prep.
Yeah, that's a really good, important piece of advice. Okay, a stupid question from our friend Craig Allen, one of the better lifters going around. This is probably an even better Instagram name than Potsy's. He's gone from Craigstagram to the better one, which is Incredible Bulk. So...
And it's relevant because he's a large man.
Yeah, he's huge now. And he's got like something between like a Soviet weightlifter and a Mario moustache. I love it. Anyway, he says, why does Alex feel the need to trash talk your bench from like 2 kilos ahead? And this is coming from somebody who benches like 190. Alex, justify yourself.
First of all, it's 10 kilos ahead.
Why-ish.
No, it's exactly 10.
Well, you did 145 in comp, but...
Yes, I did.
Have you benched more than 145 ever?
That's not the point. What's your best comp bench?
135.
Yeah, so 10 kilos less. So, yeah. Craig, it's actually 10 kilos ahead, and it's also a weight class below, so, you know.
Yeah, well...
How much your bench? .net?
I benched 140 in the gym, so there. And my dad benched 500. Everyone saw him. Shut up. All right, come on, Alex. Next question.
All right, this one is from Manu El Cole on Instagram.
I think that's Manuel Cole.
Maybe
like,
Manuel
like Cole. Manuel. Like Manuel?
Yeah, maybe.
Manuel Cole. We don't know him.
Some guy. Does powerlifting really increase the size of one's testicles? And do powerlifters get laid more often than bodybuilders?
In my experience, no and no. Do you want to move on from there, or
yeah, that sucks.
That's stupid. All right, Rory.Griffin, big fan of the show. Goes by Rory Griffin in real life, or you could call him Rory.Griffin. He'd respond. He says, for someone undersized for their height, how much time should be spent in high volume phases to get Jack 3D? That's a reference to the band pre workout supplement versus high intensity.
Shout out to Jesse Norris.
Shout out Jesse Norris. Honestly, potential goat powerlifter. To get jacked versus high-intensity comp prep. So he says, if you're undersized, how much time should you spend in hypertrophy phases versus high-intensity phases? And do you delay filling out a weight class or should you get jacked ASAP? Alex?
Okay, so we're going to do a long episode with Luke Tulloch on this eventually. But I think very broadly, if you are undersized and under-muscled for your weight class, you should spend the majority of your time trying to fill out the class. So that's going to mean the majority of your training at a higher volume. So probably don't do 5 comps a year.
Yeah.
And if you are going to compete, I would do a much less aggressive peaking phase. So I would spend more time training at higher volumes and sort of peak very quickly towards the end. So you're still getting lots of reps, you know, 6 to 3 weeks out from the comp. And no, you should not delay filling out a weight class. You should get jacked ASAP, yes. Learn from experience.
Vague agreement, some disagreement, as usual. So how much time should we spend in high volume phases? More. So agree with Alex there. Here's how I think about it. I actually wrote like a chapter for a book about this once that I never published. So I'll talk about it probably on the podcast. But being in a hypercaloric state, so eating in a surplus, it is beneficial for the training effects that you are after in every training phase. It obviously helps for hypertrophy. It helps for strength training because it helps you recover faster, it helps you handle more volume, helps you perform better. Yeah, there's every reason to think it helps in strength, and it obviously helps in peaking as well because you need to recover more. And so there's never a time that it's actually bad to be in a surplus. The problem with long-term surpluses is that eventually you get overfat and have to cut, and there are negatives to being in a hypocaloric state in every phase as well. During a hypertrophy phase, I think it defeats the purpose because you're not going to put on much muscle at all. During a strength phase, it sucks because you need to be recovered better to handle heavy loads. And during a peaking phase, it really, really sucks because the whole point of peaking is to reduce fatigue. So then the question sort of becomes, when is it strategically best to be gaining weight? The answer is hypertrophy phases, peaking phases and strength phases can benefit or can be just as fine probably during maintenance, and cutting weight should happen, in my opinion, during strength phases because you're doing enough heavy tension work to maintain muscle mass, and not so much that you can't hack it without a large amount of energy coming in. I have a lot more to say, but Alex is poking his finger up.
I think you said earlier that you think being in a surplus is a good idea during a peaking phase. I would actually disagree.
You're disagreeing on the basis of your leverages changing if you gain weight?
Yes.
Okay, I can agree with that, but I think that in the sort of 3 to 6 weeks that you're peaking, unless you're like super bulking, you're not likely to gain more than like a kilo or so. So I don't think it makes a practical difference. And by the time I finish this point, you'll realize that my advice isn't to actually be bulking through your peak necessarily. It's to say that you don't want to cut then, and your biggest marginal benefit from gaining weight is in hypertrophy phases, which is why I think we should skew more time towards them.
Of course.
But there is a limitation on that as well, and there's a couple. I think you should listen to another podcast. It was a Revive Stronger podcast. Mike Israetel and Eric Helms were talking about bulking, I believe, and they specifically spoke about the point of gaining weight. When you're getting fatter, do you gain proportionally more fat or muscle? I think Eric Helms actually won the point in saying that you don't. You don't gain excess fat, at least until you're really, really over fat. So I don't think that's a problem. But what I do think is a problem is that there's only so much room that you sort of have to do continuous hypertrophy phases before, just to actually continue to progress well in your training, you need a change towards something like strength. So what I think should happen for people who are undersized is that they do longer and more consecutive hypertrophy phases, but that's still going to top out at sort of 3 to 4 months at a time, just because past that point, if you've progressed from doing 15s to doing like 8s or 6s, you just don't have much room to go. And then I think you get a lot of synergistic benefit from going to a strength phase, during which time I think you should maintain your body weight or gain weight at a slower rate. And then from there, you can go back to hypertrophy phases or go into a peak. But what that tends to mean is basically that you lengthen hypertrophy phases, shorten strength phases a little bit to use them for synergistic benefit with hypertrophy phases, and either compete on a short peak or go back to hypertrophy once. And so, yeah, I think it's sort of 3 to 4 months at a time, 4 to 6 weeks at a time. So 3 to 4 months at a time in hypertrophy, 4 to 6 weeks at a time in strength phases, and then either like a super short 2 to 3 week peak or back to hypertrophy. Alex, you're leaning forward.
I'm in agreement with you there.
Yep.
I think we do when we're trying to fill out an entire weight class. Like if you're going from 93 to 105,
yeah,
you're not going to go straight from 93 to 105.
No, never.
There's going to be periods where you're going to have periods, you know, maybe it is 3 months of inner surplus and then strategic mini cuts along the way.
Yeah, or even just strategic maintenance phases. I think people underestimate how valuable it is to literally just maintain the weight that you've gained for a while. And although people sort of say recomposition's a myth, it's been my personal experience that if you do maintain weight and actually train progressively, you can get small recomp benefits. But the main thing is just that, like, you start to get used to lifting at that weight, your hunger goes back to like normal levels, because if you gain weight for ages, you just never want to eat, and if you lose weight for ages, you get ravenous. So it's good to just sort of let things settle a bit before you push again. Alex?
I think if we use this in like a powerlifting competition context.
Yes.
Let's say this lifter is going to compete every 5 months.
Yeah.
So the first 3 months, we're going to be in a higher volume phase and we're going to be eating in a relatively aggressive surplus.
Yeah.
Maybe 10% surplus.
Yeah, okay, sure. Percentages is fine, yeah.
Then the next month, we might do a strength block at a smaller surplus, maybe 5% surplus.
Yes.
And then the peaking phase for 4 weeks
maintenance.
At maintenance.
Yes.
So that 4 week maintenance is enough to sort of reset hunger levels, get us used to training at those leverages,
yeah,
and also the benefit of peaking while at maintenance.
Yeah.
And then straight back to the 3 month hypertrophy block again.
Yeah.
And so if you were to run that sort of cycle of 5 months for maybe 3 times,
yeah,
you're probably up 6 or 8 kilos.
Yeah, so I was going to say, if you actually track that in terms of body weight gain, so a relatively aggressive surplus for an intermediate lifter might see you gaining 1 to 1.5% of your body weight per month. So if you're an 83 going to 93s, that means you gain about 1 kilo a month during your hypertrophy phase. So you go up 1 kilo a month for 3 to 4 months, you've gained 3 to 4 kilos. Your strength phase, you're gaining at about half that rate, so, you know, 0.5 kilo a month. So again, total, you've gone up 3.5 to 4 kilos across 4 months, which is great because you're not getting fat doing that, but you're getting all of the benefit you would get from excess energy. Then you maintain during your peaking phase, do that again. That means it might be, yeah, nearly 3 cycles of that before you've actually filled out the 93s, and then you might need to do a couple of actual cutting phases and bulking again. So it could be over a 2-year project to fill out a weight class 10 kilos above where you're currently sitting. And even after that, there's probably room for refinement, because a true 93 kilo powerlifter is like pretty lean at 96 to 97 kilos. And if you're an 83 who's like lean at 86, 87 kilos, you've got a long way to go before you fill it out. So anyway, yeah, long-term strategic planning and make sure it's synergistic with your training. Full episode talking about that coming up with Luke Tulloch eventually.
I think an important takeaway from that is this stems back to everything that we ever talk about, is planning things in advance.
Yes.
And having a plan before you just go for it.
Yeah.
So don't go, oh, I'm going to go up a weight class, and you just eat more food.
Yeah.
Or like, yeah, cool.
I mean, that can work.
That can work.
It actually works really well. It does. But it can work better.
It could work better if we plan, you know, what we're going to do a year in advance or 6 months in advance. Have some sort of an idea before you just go and do whatever it is you're going to do.
All right.
That goes for training as well. Everything.
Okay, we're screaming up on half an hour since we last took a break. So again, we'll take a break.
Weekly Weights. Welcome back to Weekly Weights. We're going to finish the Q&A here with a couple more questions. The first one, this one's for you, Will. Is Will single?
Yeah, ass. Alright. Who's that by?
At financial underscore panda.
Oh yeah.
Slide into Will's DMs. He is single.
Alright. Yeah, not for long after this episode goes out. Alright. Next one was from Sutts Strong. This is Alex Sutton. So Sutts underscore strong on Instagram says, "Hey bro," that's me. "Can you explain the difference between a pure powerlifting program versus a power builder style program, and explain why the pure powerlifting program results in better strength gains?" Alex first.
I'll start. So I guess the difference between a pure powerlifting program and a power builder style program is kind of the phase in which you are training in. So I guess you would use a quote unquote power builder style program where you're doing more accessory volume and you're doing your main lifts at a higher volume during your sort of general prep phase, your hypertrophy phase, your volume phases, which are going to be early on in your competition prep, I guess. And then you're going to sort of transition into a more sort of normal, I guess, quote unquote, normal powerlifter program the closer you get to the competition. So obviously that means we place the priority higher on the power lifts and we take the priority away from getting jacked or, you know, all the other things, because the focus then is performing in the competition.
Sure. In application, I pretty much agree with Alex. I actually define the difference between them differently. So I would consider a pure powerlifting program one that is tailored to maximize performance in the powerlifts, which is self-evident. Maximizing performance in the powerlifts means also maximizing your ability to lift within the rules of powerlifting, which means a much more emphasis given to technical mastery of the powerlifts. Whereas a power builder program, I think, has an interest in developing strength, and often that strength in the powerlifts, although you could have a inverted commas power building program where you wanted to get your safety bar squat, hex bar deadlift, and overhead press good too. So, but yeah, you might have an interest in developing the powerlifts, but you're not interested in necessarily being maximally efficient. You just want to get stronger at moving weight and also get bigger at the same time. So for me, the difference why a pure powerlifting program results in better strength gains, it's not necessarily that you actually get stronger, in inverted commas, although I think what Alex said about phasic structure is important. It's not necessarily that you get stronger. It's that the powerlifting program's hard endpoint is your ability to lift weight from A to B in squat, bench, and deadlift under competition rules, and that's your strength measurement. Whereas the power building program is like you want to see a bit of that and also see increases in size, and so you're not focusing as much on mastery. On mastery per se. What Alex said about phasic structure, I agree with entirely. So even if you want to take a power building approach, I think that's perfectly viable for developing as a powerlifter, but you need to sort of have a little bit of power and a lot of build in your off season, and then a lot of power and not much build during your peak. And again, I feel like we could do an entire episode talking about the subtleties of how you would change X, Y, and Z there, but that's the main thing.
I think to answer the second question, why the powerlifting program results in better strength gains, it's more of a skill thing,
yes,
than it is a strength thing. So you may get as strong doing the power builder type of thing, but you're not able to display that strength because you haven't practiced the lifts maybe more frequently, you haven't been handling them at a higher intensity,
yeah,
and you've been doing other volume aside from that, which interferes with your ability to perform the main lifts and recover from the main lifts.
Yes.
So I think, like I said earlier, you would use more of a pure powerlifting program, in inverted commas, as you prep for a competition, maybe the last 6 weeks of your prep.
Yeah.
And then what you're able to do then is display that strength on game day.
Yeah. So I would say, like, for me, inverted commas off-season programming is, you know, much more like do some squats and do some quad and hip and stuff accessory work and some abs, you know, do some bench, do heaps of upper body bodybuilding work, do some deadlifts, do some hips, lower back, hamstring, accessory work, and do sort of a meld of that and train, yeah, in a bit more of a power building manner. But as competitions come around, suddenly you're squatting, you know, 2 to 4 times a week, you're benching or doing a variation 2 to 4 times a week, you're deadlifting a couple of times a week, and the proportion of accessory work drops a lot. So, you know, and I think that's sensible, and I think that's what a lot of good programs look like. Next question, Alex, you have one.
Yes, so this is from Aiden Potts again at Potsteria Chain. When do you think would be the right time to alter or change the technique for the squat, bench, or deadlift? and he gave a couple of examples, i.e. max width bench press, sumo to conventional or vice versa, flats versus heels, etc.
Okay, I'm going to give a really trite and short answer. A long way from comp, unless there's a really obvious indication that you need to do that immediately. But the closer to comp you get, the less I would be inclined to do it. And then I also think you need to sort of draw a line somewhere between what is like a technical tweak and like a hard technical change. So if somebody's squatting and there's something that's, you know, a 1 or 2% that's obviously making a difference, you can change that literally while they're warming up for comp, and that would be fine. But if it's like a major change, like, oh man, you need to change your foot position or whatever it happens to be, change your whole process approaching the bar, that's the type of thing you want to do a long way out from comp. So yeah, basically as far out as possible, unless it's just amazingly obvious that it has to happen immediately. Alex?
Yeah, I think these things don't just happen all at once. I think developing a technique for the individual takes a long time.
Yes.
And I think there's going to be little tweaks along the way that we make to sort of eventuate in our final technique, I guess.
Yeah.
So it might just be something that the coach notices, like, you know, maybe your external rotation at the hip isn't great and your knees come in a little bit in the hole and you're squatting in a quite a wide stance. The coach might say, okay, maybe bring your stance in a little bit.
Yeah.
So that you get that, you know, direct travel through ankle, knee, hip. Those kind of things sort of just happen as you go. And I think changing anything too much at once can be a problem.
Yeah.
So if you go like, you squat high bar in heels, narrow stance, and then all of a sudden we're going to go, okay, you're in flats, you're squatting wide, and you're squatting low bar. You're doing three changes all at once.
Yeah, it's essentially a variation.
Yeah, you're probably not going to get what you want immediately. So it might be a good idea to say, okay, let's squat high bar and flats with the same stance, and then, you know, do that for 4 weeks, and then take the stance a little bit wider, do that for 4 weeks, and again wider, do that for 4 weeks, and then bring the bar down the back, yeah, or something like that. So small little tweaks over time result in essentially what we want.
Yeah, and I've got two additions to that. So one is that when you're making technical changes, you need to sort of temper your expectations, because it's not all the time that it's going to feel amazingly good straight away. There's two reasons. One is unfamiliarity, obviously. And sometimes, even though it might have a higher sort of ceiling for development, it will be, you know, the new stance will ask you to use muscles or movement patterns that are less well developed. And then number two is because automation, so doing things without conscious input, is literally like an energy and effort preserving mechanism that your brain uses during motor learning. So when you have to reinvest a lot of thought in performing a new technique, it will feel disproportionately harder, literally by virtue of the fact that you're actually having to concentrate on facets of your technique that you can normally take for granted. And so when you're, as a coach or as a lifter, planning for that, sometimes you have to be deliberately conservative in the loads you use or the RPEs you prescribe and stuff, just to accommodate the fact that it's gonna feel disproportionately harder than it should. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, yeah, to add to that, it's almost like the lifter is a beginner again.
Yes.
So we're following the same principles that we would use for a beginner. So making sure things are technically, you know, as perfect as we can get, and keeping loading and volume lower than we would if the lifter was more proficient. I think another thing to add to that is the question of, do we really need a change?
Yeah.
If your squat went from 205 to 210 in 3 months, that was a progression. So if we're trying to make changes because we weren't progressing as fast as we wanted, well, maybe let's just like hold on a second and let's realize that we still progressed, and let's just keep things the same again. So sometimes changing things too often and too much can be more of a detriment than not changing things at all.
Yeah, I think I can agree with that. And yeah, there's some degree to which maybe just improving the cards you're dealt is worthwhile. Just like, you know, work within the technique somebody's got and start with smaller tweaks. Okay. I've got one from our most motivational fan, the man himself, Jack Young. Got Jack Motivate on Instagram.
Jack, that's a boy. Did you see his squat last night?
Yeah, he smoked it. It was good.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, Jack, whose technical improvements, particularly in the squat and deadlift, I admire, wrote to me and he said, game day nutrition. What should I eat on comp day? Jack, my brother, you can eat whatever you want on comp day. Particularly after comp, you can eat whatever you want. But if you're interested in performing the best that you can, I have a few things that I would say. Number one mistake that lots of people make is actually eating too much. I think I said this earlier in this Q&A, powerlifting on comp day doesn't actually have enormously high energy requirements. You're doing 3 lifts, so you don't need to be cramming a huge amount of food down your gullet. What you do want to have are things that sit in you well, that can contain mostly carbohydrates and relatively low food bulk, and a reasonable amount of fluid. So I'll get to specific examples in a second, but I would also try and avoid, even though people like having lots of lollies and things, I would try and avoid having a huge, huge amount of fruit and lollies, because just having too much fructose can often sort of draw a bit of extra water into your bowel and lead you to suddenly have the shits, which you don't want. But have a reasonable amount of carbohydrate, have a reasonable amount of fluid, have things that sit in you well, don't have unfamiliar foods, and only really have a little bit because you don't need that much, Alex.
Yeah, I think on that point, don't take any risks with your food.
Yes.
Don't, like, if you haven't eaten a food for a certain time because you've had to stay within your weight class or whatever, and you've been really craving that food, wait till after the comp to eat it.
Yes.
Don't eat it after your weigh-in because you might feel sick because it's unfamiliar in your stomach.
Yeah.
Another thing is how we eat if we didn't cut weight versus if we did cut weight is very different.
Yeah.
If we did cut weight, we need to replenish what we've lost, which is going to be water, electrolytes, and carbohydrates.
Yes.
So those are the priority in that instance. If you didn't cut weight, eat what you would normally eat before you train, just
yep.
on any given day, maybe with a little bit extra water, just to stay a little bit more sort of fluffy. Bloated, I guess.
I'm going to literally walk through a comp day and I'm going to stop at each moment and let Alex maybe throw out what he thinks of what I've said in each instance. So breakfast on comp day depends on whether or not you've made weight, but like pretty well irrespective, I would go for something that's relatively calorie dense, and this is probably the meal in your day that's going to have the most fats in it, you know, because it's calorie dense. But have something with a bit of protein, bit of fats, and then depending on how your weight's doing, get some carbohydrates in. But good examples would be like an omelet with some toast, or like some peanut butter on toast, or drink a glass of milk with any of them, but actually get some energy into you because it's likely to be a far way from when you're competing. That's presuming that you actually have the room to make weight. Alex, so far?
I mean, I've never been able to eat breakfast on comp day, so I can't really comment.
Okay. So,
but if I was able to, I'd probably have eggs on toast and a bowl of cereal.
Yeah, okay. So my point is, though, get something that's actually a little bit solid into you. It'll probably help you poop. But yeah, get something solid into you, get some protein, get some fats, get a little bit of carbs. Then you actually go to weigh in. You go to weigh in, and immediately after your weigh in, your first emphasis, in my opinion, should be on having something with some electrolytes and carbohydrates. So a really good example is a sports drink. Even if you haven't cut weight, there's every reason to think that's going to be beneficial. So I would start sipping a Powerade or something. And then again, immediately post weigh-in would be when you would have your next most actually like solid meal. I would go for starchier carbohydrates, a little bit of fat, and sparing protein, but not much of either fat or protein. So again, good idea in this instance might be like have a Powerade and then have a peanut butter sandwich, or you know, a Powerade and a small, like a tiny bit of a stir fry with some rice or some fried rice. But again, don't pump food down. You don't want to be like full to the point of being sick. Just have like a decent pre-training snack, remembering that you're going to start lifting in, what, 45 minutes to 60 minutes after you weigh in normally?
Right? Local comp. 90 food. Minutes.
Yeah.
But, you know,
If you're last to weigh in. Yeah.
45 to 60 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, so you don't really need to pump much. And then once you've had about half that Powerade, you can dilute it and continue to sip it during your warm-ups. After squat, you can afford to have, a little snack. So, again, nothing bigger than a PB sandwich to me, to be honest. Like, I would literally have a little chocolate bar or, like, you know, a little muffin or something. But you don't need a lot of food because, you just don't need the energy and you want it to sit in you well. So have a small snack, continue to sip water or sip a sports drink. I don't think you should be having more than about a litre of a sports drink across the day unless you've actually been dehydrating to make weight, in which case all this advice gets more complicated. So a bit of water, small snack. After bench, I would literally have a few jelly lollies or something, and that's about it, and then just smash caffeine. Alex is nodding his head because he loves caffeine, but that's it. So really, when you think about it, between weigh-in and your final deadlift, I don't think you need more than like a bottle of Powerade, a peanut butter sandwich, a few lollies, and like, you know, another small snack of your choice, just something that sits with you well, like an LCM's bar, honestly fine.
Salt and vinegar chips.
But yeah,
the bomb.
But good choices. Contain some salt, contain some potassium, so bananas are fine too. Contain some salt, contain some potassium, sip some fluids, and sit with you well. And beyond that, yeah, just don't smash food. You really don't need it.
The biggest thing is don't eat too much, because you don't want to feel sick.
Yeah. I've seen more people eat too much than not eat enough, to be honest. Just put it through that lens, and then afterwards, yeah, go eat a good feed and relax.
Have 10 beers and a pizza.
Yeah, or if you're me, 2 beers and 10 pizzas. All right. That was my final question. Do you have any more, Alex?
No.
Sick. Guys, hope that was an enjoyable episode for you. We don't even need to do the 4 questions to tell us everything we need to know about a person this time, because we've already done it.
Do you have any more, though? Do you have anything that you want to know about me, Will?
To be honest, no. I'm pretty sick of you. Do you have anything you want to know about me?
No, I hate you.
All right. I'm Will Berkman, so Instagram is at w.berkmanpt, willberkman.com, Will Berkman on Facebook.
You can find me at alexhayes_lift.
Peace.
See ya. Weekly weights. Drop it in.
With your mates. We lift weights. Say Jimmy for you.
Cheers. Weekly weights.
I got an idea for a lyric jingle. Weights and mates, we're your mates, and we lift weights, gym and footy.